Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Robert Crowther at the Center for Science and Culture in Seattle. And today it is with some sadness that we focus on the passing of Philip Johnson. Philip Johnson was the original program advisor to the Center for Science and Culture and a key supporter since the center's inception in 1996. In fact, Bill Johnson was one of the speakers at the center's inaugural conference that year in Seattle, along with Michael Behe and others. And that was the first time that I got to meet him. I didn't know him terribly well, but I thought in remembering Phil, I would ask someone to join us today who did know him for a long time, and that is CSC fellow, biologist, and author, Dr. Jonathan Wells. Welcome, Jonathan.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Let me just give a quick background on Phil for listeners. Philip Johnson was a law professor emeritus of UC Berkeley's Bolt Hall School of Law. He was also the author of a landmark book, Darwin on Trial, where he put Darwin's theory on trial and exposed its lack of scientific evidence. And that book really struck a chord with lots of scientists and scholars and ultimately led to Phil being widely recognized as the godfather of the contemporary intelligent design movement. And as I mentioned, I didn't know him all that well, but I know that you did, Jonathan. And so I'm hoping maybe we can talk a little bit about him. You can share some of your remembrances of Phil and his impact on the overall debate over the years.
Sure.
I've heard many of the stories about his early involvement in the ID community. And it sometimes sounded to me like he was the one that helped that community to coalesce. Maybe he's the one who brought it all together. Is that right?
Definitely. It was through Phil that I ended up meeting people like Steve Meyer, Mike Behe, Bill Dembski, Paul Nelson, Doug Acts, and so on.
Right. So early on, you guys didn't know each other, all of these various people that were getting interested in this idea of intelligent design, and yet Phil somehow connected all of you together.
Yes, well, I was a graduate student in biology at UC Berkeley in 1991 when Phil's landmark book came out, Darwin on Trial. And I was already interested in the Darwinian controversies, and I was already a skeptic of Darwinian evolution. But when I heard about his book, I didn't want to read it because so much of what I had read on the subject was second rate, and I couldn't be bothered. But a biochemist friend who knew me and Phil urged me to try it, and so I picked the book up. And once I started, I couldn't put it down. It was so good.
Wow.
At the end, I wanted to cheer. And instead of cheering, I called Phil up on the phone because he was just across campus from me. And in a day or two, we were having lunch together. I brought our mutual friend along, the one who had convinced me to read the book, because I had a very checkered past. Back in the 60s, as a Berkeley undergraduate, I had been an anti-war activist. And I knew from his reputation that Phil was politically conservative. So I went to lunch with my friend to help mediate our obvious differences. But it turned out not to be necessary. Phil had such a big spirit and was so warm and loving that we instantly became good friends and remained so for years.
So you read this book, and it's by a lawyer. It's not by a scientist. And this is at a early time when it was just beginning to be some real scientific skepticism of Darwin's theory after it had not been challenged on solid scientific grounds for a long time. What was it like to think, you know, here's an attorney of all people, why is he writing a book about Darwin?
Well, that's one reason why I was reluctant to read it. At the time, I was actually unaware of Bradley, Thaxton, and Olson's book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. I was also unaware of Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. And I thought, how could a lawyer possibly write a good book on this subject? But the reason he could is because his logic is like a laser. He just pierces through all the nonsense and fog and gets right to the important issues. And that's what made his book so impressive to me.
That's pretty interesting. It wasn't just you that was impressed. Obviously, all of these people that you've been mentioning, all of them pretty much became affiliated in one way or another with the Center for Science and Culture in the early 90s. But it was Phil, what was it about him that managed to convince all these disparate people in various places and programs and different disciplines of science too? How did he bring that together?
Well, the first thing Phil did, as I recall, is he was very much into new technology. And so he set up an online email list and connected us all through email, even before we met physically. And that list still exists under slightly different form. And that's what got things started for me. The next thing was, in 1993, Phil himself put together a meeting, Phil and his wife, that is, near Monterey. It was actually a place called Pajaro Dunes.
Right.
So it became famous as the Pajaro Dunes meeting. And there I physically met Steve Meyer, Paul Nelson, Doug Axe, Bill Dembski, and many other people. Mike B., I forgot to mention. And that really, for me, was the genesis of the modern intelligent design movement.
Yeah, so that was the first time all of you met, at least all together, and it was the first time that you had met most or all of those people in person, isn't that right?
That's right. And we had informal discussions in the house that Phil had rented, and then in the evening we would take long walks along the beach and really get to know each other. It was an amazing experience.
And it is interesting, that history of how this came about, putting all these people together, because I know in talking with you and others, there were a lot of people that had, shall we say, doubts about Darwin. They were skeptical, but they didn't recognize that there were people in all these other fields. And so that's what Phil did that was so great, was to start showing each of you and others that, no, it's not just your area. It's not just in biology or just in chemistry. It's across the board. This whole idea of this materialistic origin story is not holding up. The evidence doesn't support it. And I think that's pretty amazing, is that he was able to connect those dots, so to speak, you all being the dots who came together and have had this huge impact on the overall scientific debate.
Yes, and another amazing feature of Phil's thinking, which was present there at Pajaro Dunes, was his idea of what he called a big tent. So what united us was the conviction that we could infer from evidence in nature that some things, including some living things, are better explained by design than by unguided natural processes. But the meeting itself and the movement since then has included young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, people who believe in universal common ancestry, those who are skeptical of that, people who are Christian, Muslim, Jews, atheists, Hindus, and whatever, all are welcome. And that, to me, has been a tremendous source of strength for the intelligent design movement.
Yeah, it was really insightful for him, looking to the future, to be able to unite people from disparate backgrounds, disciplines, points of view on all sorts of things, and to be able to come around a very sharply focused single idea that it's not just unguided processes, but rather there is evidence for actual design in nature. And just examining that key concept and that idea, and scientifically, without getting into a lot of the other debates that are peripheral to that, it's pretty amazing.
Yes, it is. And you mentioned earlier that Phil was instrumental in getting the Center for Science and Culture started in Seattle. He was. The center was actually started by Steve Meyer, John West, and Bruce Chapman here at the Discovery Institute. But Phil was the man behind the scenes, the inspiration, the encouragement for getting this all going. So finally, from 1996 on, intelligent design has had an institutional home here in Seattle.
Yeah, he was also, I believe, and maybe you know better, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that he was one of the early proponents of teaching the evidence on both sides, the evidence that supports Darwin's theory and the evidence that challenges it, and that that was the correct approach as far as education went. Is that right, that that was kind of an idea that he came up with first, or that he was instrumental in helping to shape that approach?
Well, I don't know if he's the first one to think of it, but he's certainly the one that made it prominent. Mm-hmm. And also made it the official strategy of the Discovery Institute. Instead of banning evolution from the curriculum or requiring the simultaneous teaching of creationism, Phil's attitude was, we just need to teach students more rather than less about evolution. And that includes the evidence against it as well as for it.
And I know that he was an advisor, and he was prominent at the time when there were a lot of these debates were starting to come up in the late 90s in Kansas, right around the turn of the century, and then in Ohio and so on. And that these approaches to education, that was what he championed. And it's what the Center for Science and Culture was really saying was the best approach. And I know you were involved, especially in Kansas, isn't that right, with some of the work that they did on their science standards initially?
I was involved in Kansas and also in Ohio.
Yeah.
And in both cases, the Darwinists, who had the collaboration of the news media by and large,
right,
would portray us as creationists who are trying to kick evolution out of the curriculum, which was never true. Or they portrayed us as creationists who are trying to get intelligent design forced into the curriculum. And that wasn't true either. We just wanted the evidence presented truthfully.
Right. And as an attorney, a lawyer, Phil Johnson had that insight with Darwin on Trial, and then later in how that could be rolled out in an education setting that was, you know, pedagogically a good idea and so on. So he really had a big lasting impact on the overall debate.
Yes, he did. And I think in large measure, his impact was due to his personality. He was sharp as a tack, even after he suffered some strokes a few years back. Mm-hmm. He was mentally just as good as ever. And the fact that he embraced people from so many different backgrounds, he could even relate on a friendly basis to enemies. He and atheist Will Provine were good friends, even
wow,
though they totally disagreed on the issues. And for me, that's what makes Phil Johnson a really, really great man. If he were in India, had been in India, I think he would have earned the title Mahatma, which means great soul. Philip was a great soul.
Yeah. Now, I know earlier this year, there was a reunion of sorts of that original Pajaro Dunes meeting. And I understand that Phil was not able to physically attend, but he was able to conference in for part of that. That must have been interesting to have that interaction with him so long after the original meeting. Then here we are marking these milestones.
Yes, it was a wonderful reunion. The most prominent feature of the reunion for me, besides getting together again with old friends and many new ones, was to learn how much the intelligent design movement has spread since the original Pajaro Dunes meeting. It's truly an international movement now, and we had some international representatives there at the reunion back in March.
Yeah, it is international. I mean, we have connections with people in Brazil and the United Kingdom and in Germany and Austria and Spain and Italy and in South Korea and in Japan and various other places around the world as well. And it's pretty amazing that in just really only a few decades, thanks to Phil's insights early on, it has spread kind of like wildfire.
Yes, it has. It's truly amazing. And I was privileged enough to sit in on a report just a few weeks ago that made it clear that the movement is spreading far faster and far wider than we can even mention publicly, because the fact is it's still a very controversial idea in some circles. People have to be careful or they'll lose their jobs. In fact, some have. So you might even call it an underground movement in some ways. Its influence is far greater than you would realize from reading the media.
And a lot of that can be attributed to the godfather, quote unquote, of the contemporary intelligent design movement, Philip Johnson.
Yes.
I want to thank you, Jonathan, for taking the time joining us today to remember Phil Johnson. I really appreciate your thoughts and your memories about all of this.
It's been a pleasure, Rob.
For all of our listeners out there, I encourage you to visit Evolution News at evolutionnews.org for more coverage and thoughts on Philip Johnson and his impact on the overall debate over evolution and intelligent design. I know that they will be having some thoughts from various center scientists and scholars and others. That's at evolutionnews.org. And you can find out more about Phil's great book, Darwin on Trial, at darwinontrial.com. Again, thanks to Jonathan Wills for being with us. I'm Robert Crowther with the CSC. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.